Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hi, this is Laura Stark. I'm associate professor at Vanderbilt University. This interview is a collaborative effort among myself, author Anthony Hatch, and students in the Vanderbilt course, Prison Medicine. And our reading of Hatch's book, Silent Cells, came at the end of a semester of deep and extensive readings of authors from Frederick Douglass to Fanon, Angela Davis to Ruth Wilson Gilmore. Yet Hatch's analysis in Silent Cells added a fundamentally new and necessary dimension to our understanding of incarceration and our spaces for political action. Silent Cells observes a feature of mass incarceration that is essential to its everyday function. Prison elites' large-scale, persistent administration of psychotropic drugs, including antipsychotics and antidepressants, not for medical care, but for political pacification of incarcerated people. This biochemical, quote-unquote, soul murder, as Hatch calls it, is as unjust as it is inefficient, profit-driven, and poorly tracked, and extends to other settings of what Hatch refers to as captive America, including the military, foster care, elder care, and international detention centers. Silent Cells is a work of liberatory social science. It's of a piece with Hatch's abolitionist agenda that he pursues through his really generous scholarly and activist work, including as director of the Black Box Teaching Laboratory and as chair of the program in Science and Society at Wesleyan University. I loved Hatch's generous approach to this interview, and I'm really keen to hear any of your feedback on our conversation. I'm happy to share my prison medicine syllabus and to talk with teachers about ways to develop new books interviews as final collective projects for your courses. You can find me online at Vanderbilt University. I'm talking with Professor Tony Hatch in April of 2022, and we are the students, the learners of the book Silent Cells through the course at Vanderbilt University called Prison Medicine. So, Professor Hatch, I want to start off by just framing the book a bit. It's looking at psychotropics and specifically in psychotropic use in what you call captive America. And as we understand it, this tacks to a moment in mass incarceration. But the use of psychotropics in the way that you're showing is not exclusive to what are conventionally understood as carceral settings or prisons. But you talk in the book about the military use of psychotropics and elderly homes, the foster system. And what's really revealing about your analysis, among many things, is that we know the critique a bit, and it's very important, that psychotropics are overused as a form of therapy for mental illnesses, as opposed to things like talk therapy, so a reliance on pharmaceuticals for therapeutic purposes. But what you're showing is that pharmaceuticals are actually used for behavioral management. It's actually a huge portion of it is not attached at all to the idea of the health of people in carceral settings.
but instead simply to making the lives of people who are having to operate in these bureaucratic settings be able to do it more smoothly. So it's just behavioral control. And for us anyway, that was not just an extension of what we already knew, but a fundamental different area to understand in terms of how incarceration works. So to start off, could you talk a bit about the distinction you want to make between incarceration and captivity? Because you emphasize that what you're talking about is captive America, which is related to bureaucracy, but it's bigger than just prison settings. Could you explain that a bit?
Indeed. The term captive America is meant to encapsulate a set of social institutions that, through various legal and non-legal mechanisms, different constituencies have empowered these institutions to hold other people captive against their will for various reasons. That form of confinement or captivity can as Irving Goffman famously analyzed, can be for purposes of religious training and instruction. College students, certainly, who go and leave home and go, you know, live on campus for 4 years, experience a form of this. And actually, school officials actually do maintain a form of kind of authority over those students in a certain sense. So the legal apparatus, the legal relationship between an institution and the subject is what really defines this form of captivity, where we are empowered to hold you against your will, whether that be for purposes of education, whether it be for purposes of care for the convalescent, of parentage for the ward, right, for the child whose parents can't care for them or who has lost their parents. Right, these forms of captivity are related to and bureaucratically, legally related to the form of confinement that you see in mass incarceration vis-a-vis prisons and jails in the United States. And it basically has to do with the power of the state, right? We grant this power to the state, to the nation state, and various apparatuses and institutions within the state to hold people against their will. And it's that form of captivity that is again present in prisons, present in jails, and certainly most famously so, but also exists in these other institutional settings where it turns out psychotropics are also used in ways that make it very difficult to determine what is a proper medical use versus what is a use that is more in alignment with institutional prerogatives, that makes it cheaper to house people, that makes it easier for the people on the staff that day. You know, discerning those, that boundary turns out to be a very difficult thing to do, but it across these different contexts. But they, you know, and there's different, you know, I think in writing the book, I learned a lot about how different institutions grapple with this problem of over-medication, mis-medication, and medication in general. But it's linked to their particular institutional purpose, whether it's to hold people against their will in a secret prison, or versus caring for our elders who need full-time care, or people who have committed crimes against the state and therefore are incarcerated.
Yeah, it really seems to expand a lot of concepts that people might know from Weber on bureaucracy and think through it in terms of racial capitalism. So in addition to the bureaucratic state, the capitalist democratic state and how those two things of bureaucracy and capitalism are linked, and the impacts in terms of sustaining racial oppression. So that it raises difficult questions that you handle so well in the book about distinguishing between different kinds of uses of psychotropics. And so here I'm going to hand it over to McKenna.
Thank you again, Dr. Hatch, for having us here. I'm just curious to see what you think on how do you particularly distinguish between the psychotropics that are generally needed and the ones that are used as a form of control?
This is a very difficult and thorny issue. One that I don't have a satisfactory resolution to even today, because the boundary, the conceptual boundary between normal medicine and spirit murder is an illusory boundary. That boundary is really permeable, and it can be recoded depending on the context. So even in the same context, I can be both medicating you because you have a diagnosed lifelong psychiatric condition that warrants treatment, and I'm also needing to make my life easier on the block today. The same practice can have both meanings at the same time. In addition to, you know, how do we actually discern at the level of the intention of the actor, you know, the pharmacist giving, dispensing, or the prescriber, what they intended to do? It's very difficult to distinguish kind of where we draw that line. What's the rationale upon which we apply to a situation that would have let us make a clean and clear determination? Okay, this was genuinely needed versus this is a form of spirit murder or psychiatric violence, in the words of Edward Upton, right? Psychic violence. It's impossible to know. And in fact, to me, that's the fact that we can't resolve that, that that's in some ways an unknowable kind of thing, or that knowing that requires that we have intimate knowledge we never actually get. That instability, that uncertainty is what is dangerous, to be honest. It's that the state, we're in a situation where the state and state actors, because they can't provide these medications themselves, have to purchase them off on the private market, right? So there's absolutely a capital connection through and through, is then dispensing these medications for a whole range of reasons, these drugs for a whole range of reasons across the country, from the military, I mean, shipping them abroad in the military. I mean, they're really everywhere. I mean, I really wish I could have evidenced this particular thing, which was that, you know, really proving that the United States government and all of its U.S. government and its the U.S. nation state and all of its institutional diversity is the single largest purchaser of psychotropics in the world by far. You add military, Medicare, Medicaid, the prisons, right? You start to add it all up and it's like, it's a lot. So figuring out for all of those doses, that's a difficult thing. But the fact that there's this uncertainty to me is dangerous, remains what's dangerous about the political situation, because there's no way to go back after the fact and say, okay, this one was right, this one wasn't. And that was, you know, even in analyzing the prison audits, pardon me, the pharmacy audits, even with full access to the medical records, they go back in and they couldn't figure it out. The auditors had difficulty often discerning what would have been a legitimate versus an illegitimate use. And so that's a practical medical issue that has epistemic or epistemological dimensions that are layered on top of them.
Super helpful. It sounds a bit like thinking about climate change and how the uncertainty, the unknowability of the claimed unknowability of what is true and what is false. It's that production of uncertainty that actually sustains really bad political conditions.
You know, in addition, you know, it just makes me think of the Michel Foucault's conception of psychiatric power and what he called the kind of double register of medication and direction, right? So just because there's a medical stamp that's applied to the situation, even though it's in a carceral setting, and because there that medical stamp is applied and the token of knowledge is distributed, the psychiatrist signs off, the double register of medication and like the direction of the will happens at the same time. And there is no way to distinguish between those analytically after the fact.
Yeah. So the in addition to this distinction between incarceration and captivity, as well as what we were just talking about in terms of legitimate and illegitimate uses of psychotropics and the irresolvability of that, another really helpful refinement that you make in the book, a distinction, is between silencing and two. You give a double meaning to silences, and particularly in chapters 1 and 2, you're setting up for the readers what you're using as data. And part of what you're using is the gaps in data production and how gaps are actively produced. And it brought to mind for me the literature in STS on agnotology, but that is probably another conversation. I'll set aside for now. For this, I'm actually going to move to Emily and have her sort of tease out this double meaning of silencing, both through the psychic death of the individuals themselves and the silencing of knowledge and any knowledge about what is actually happening in prison systems. So Emily, take it away.
Thank you. And thank you so much, Dr. Hatch, for being here. So early on in your book, you talk about the FDA adverse reporting system, especially in connection to psychotropics. And factors such as gender and age are reported. However, I noticed that race and ethnicity data is not included. I was wondering if you could talk about how leaving out these data points, there is a story that may not be told by the FDA and what you make of that.
It's a great question, Emily. And these kinds of institutional blind spots exist throughout the kind of national health infrastructure, right? This isn't the only area where there are gaps in knowledge, right? Gaps in knowledge, things that we don't know, they can exist for all kinds of reasons. And I think in writing Silent Cells, I did explore the literature on agnotology and the kind of, you know, philosophical examinations of things we don't know, and, you know, how we make sense of those, and both in philosophy and also in history and Black studies. Right, in feminist studies, thinking about how different critical scholars have really analyzed silencing practices at the level of individuals, groups, and at the level of institutions. And so I think that cuts throughout this project. Whether it's analyzing, I'm thinking of the work of Mary Lee Bundy, an archivist at my alma mater, University of Maryland College Park, where I write about in the book, who had this wonderful group called Urban Information Interpreters, and they were like on it, trying to figure out what was happening in Maryland and writing letters and making phone calls and trying to get to the bottom of it, and really identifying the problems with not knowing. In this case, it was what the racial distribution was of research subjects in this adolescent juvenile facility that was nearby that was doing all kinds of crazy experiments. And so they were trying to figure out what was happening in that context. And so that just make that example comes to mind. But you mentioned the FDA and the let's say inconsistencies in the ways in which race and ethnicity is measured in terms of the ADR system. This isn't the only area of the federal health infrastructure where racial measurement is lacking. I've recently been looking at, for example, the COVID data, and there are all sorts of intentional absences, if you will, around this. I mean, even, for example, around the question of how many people have died and how many of the people who've died are Black. We actually don't know that fully because of local differences in how race and ethnicity is measured. Even though we've got federal laws and federal code governing how this should happen, things don't get all carried out in that way. So when you look at that granular level, there's all sorts of things we don't know. It takes a leap of faith, a leap of induction, and some contextualizing to go from that to say this absence is due to a systematic, you know, coordinated effort to produce a racial silence or something, right? It takes a lot. And I think throughout the book, I kept wanting to try to be able to say that. and was really cautious, because I think Silent Cells ultimately is a conservative book. It's based upon what, I mean, everything that's in there is publicly available. There's nothing in there that required a FOIA request. Everything was open. And so this is what's available. So if this is the argument that we can make based upon what we know, then I think it's a fairly conservative argument. So what if we were to know what the racial data were in terms of adverse drug reporting across, you know, pharmacopoeia? What if we were to know the racial distribution of who participated in all these clinical trials for decades, decades and decades? Like those knowledges are potentially, they're political knowledges, right? They're mobilizing knowledges, and they would be knowledges that would destabilize the existing medical regime, whether it's for pharmacopoeia or agribusiness or other regimes. So it's a really great question, and it identifies an important area of work that I didn't set out to explore in this book. I didn't set out to explore those institutional silences. I was interested in the first, and it led to the discovery, the kind of investigation of the latter and how they were related.
Yeah. And it seems like that is a part of a feature of if you think it's really persuasive, what you're making in terms of a structural argument. So the thinking about the reasons why perhaps you can't hold individuals accountable for intentional absences is what happens with a structural account. And we did spend a lot of time thinking about issues of accountability. And Madia really formulated this well. I'll let her take it away.
Hi. So in chapter 2 on pharmacy audit studies, you show the many ways that prison officials handle or mishandle therapeutic drugs in ways that harm incarcerated people. How do you understand the role of prison officials and prison staff in the drugging of captive America? Are they pawns of the state, like incarcerated people, or are they willful agents of harm?
This is a good question. And I the first thing I want to say is that I think there's an invitation coming out of Silent Cells for qualitative researchers, people who study occupations, to interview you know, not just prison staff who currently work in the institution. One of the things I considered along the way was interviewing defectors, people who used to work for the prison, but no longer did, right? And really asking them about their views, asking them about what they saw, asking them about their experiences. I think that would be an interesting project and one that would add to, you know, some of the work that's happening in Silent Cells for sure. Early in the book, I borrow the framing of Edward Upton, who was writing in the 70s. He's a lawyer, and he said that either the pharmacy staff and the psychiatrists, the mental health staff, they're compliant accomplices, they are naive dupes, or they are kind of pressured subordinates, right? And so if they're compliant accomplices, they're in on the job, they're, you know, in there with the guards, and there certainly are cases historically where you can tell that they were, and they came out in court that they were compliant accomplices and actually faced civil or criminal penalties for such behavior. And there are plenty of cases in the case law of that. Naive dupes, I think it would be hard. It's hard to believe that someone working as a prison psychiatrist or a psychiatric nurse, forensic nurse, is walking up in there thinking, you know, naively as to what is happening in the institution. They know that there's a security context that's primary and a person context that's secondary. The primary goal is to keep the facility locked down and secure, staff safe, and we'll think about them next. That's kind of the approach. And then the pressured subordinate model is one I actually think I favor, where because of the institutional bureaucratic rules and regulations, the lack thereof in some cases, you know, these staff are in there overworked. Many of them are at the, you know, particularly for the psychiatrists, right? This isn't glorified work, right? Many of them are doing telepsychiatry. Before they rolled it out for the pandemic, they're only doing telepsychiatry. So they're on, teleconferences all day seeing patients. So I think that, they are under extraordinary institutional pressure. to achieve to get results, one way or the other. And that is both in terms of care, but also in terms of control. And so I think that that makes it difficult. And so I understand their role as ranging from a spectrum of, okay, you guys should know better, to and you are actively participating in the subordination of others in many ways that contravene U.S. law, institutional and international human rights understandings of what consent looks like, to a much more kind of business as usual model where, you know, I just work here, right? That kind of response. But I did not interview, of course, any workers in the system. And fundamentally for Silent Cells, and I write about this in the beginning, you know, I wasn't interested in their beliefs. I was interested in what the documentary record said and did not say. So in many ways, their ideas and representations are contained in those records. And so they're reflected those ways, but not in such a way where anyone would have to, you know, face me up and say, yes, I did or didn't, you know, drug this person, or yes, I did or didn't have this view about it. If that answers your question, that's a good question.
Yeah, and it speaks again to the structural claim that you're trying to make. It's not about the individual psychology. Yeah, and I just have to hand it to sociologists for coming up with the two word phrases. And this is why I love sociology. So the naive dupes, the pressured subordinates, it's great. It's so handy. And so before we move on to some of the later chapters in the book, we just wanted to push on a few of the nuts and bolts of these first two chapters, which are really setting up the landscape for what it looks like to have voids of knowledge and also what is knowable. And it's really wonderful and close reading, for example, of questions that are asked in surveys. So a lot, and the incompatibilities between different surveys and different places and moments in time. So really fantastic, and encourage folks to check it out. But we wanted to ask a little bit more about the chapter two on audit studies, in which you're talking specifically about how psychotropics are purchased, distributed, and also to a certain extent tracked within prison systems. So in terms of nuts and bolts, I'm going to hand this over to Brenna.
Okay. Hi. I know how brand name drugs are pushed in the cynic marketplace through big pharma, like through advertising and sending drug reps to doctors' offices. How are brands being pushed in the setting of captive America?
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor's the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
This is a good question, Brenna. And in chapter two of the book, the Pharmacy Prison, with my dear colleague, former student, and now out in the world, Renee Shelby, we set out to try to understand what the state knew about what it was doing. I think, you know, this started kind of innocently. You know, we're beginning a project on psychotropics. We're curious about, you know, just kind of gathering up whatever we can find. And we found a few of these audits whether it's a state government or a county government or a city government, or in some cases, the federal government, is looking at its expenditure And they're saying, God, we're spending a lot of money on X or Y. So we're going to send in the state auditor, the office of the auditor, usually a team of lawyers and accountants and other bureaucrats to go in to assess what's happening in a particular organ of the state government, city government, and so on. And so these audits, it turned out, were offered a unique window, not into the definitive truth about what's happening with psychotropics in prisons, but they offered a unique window into what institutions of state knew themselves and what was knowable from within the state, given the institutions of data collection, of accounting that they had in place, in whether it was a state government or in a city or in the federal system. So your question about brand name drugs is a really great one, right? I think that, you know, prison systems would love to know, I think, how many of what drug they're buying. Are we buying too much? How much are we paying? Did we get the coupon? I mean, I report in the book, it was one particular system they had been buying Zyprexa with the coupon, but they had run out of the coupons. And so then they had to switch to some other drug, right? The second generation atypical antipsychotic medications are especially expensive and widely used in prison systems. And so for several of them, there was a concern about how much they cost. You know, these prisons are paying full ticket, you know, for these medicines. So it was an act of real discovery for Renee and I to discover, for example, the Minnesota Multi-State Contracting Alliance for Pharmacy, MCAP, which is this, again, they're purchasing pharmacopoeia for 900 prison systems in the country. And so through they're located in the office of like minerals within the state of Minnesota, you know, in this kind of inauspicious place, but they're purchasing in mass, you know, pharmacopoeia for not just prisons, but for a whole range of state institutions that need to buy them on the cheap, right? So it provides an audit mechanism, and at least there's an accounting system somewhere, you know, that what they're buying, how much it costs year to year is all laid out. So, you know, I think, you know, maybe there's one thing I draw attention to in thinking about pharmaceutical interests in prisons is that I think Silent Cells changes our conception of our focus on privatization in prisons. That, you know, yes, there's private firms all up and down the way that are, the prisons are built by architects, and the concrete firms and the fencing and everything is provided, the entire infrastructure is provisioned by capital. And so it's not just about whether the prison itself is owned by a private corporation. These things are literally built infrastructures that are paid for by, you know, taxpayer dollars, and that money is transferred to private corporations for the purposes of capture and confinement. So, you know, the brand name drugs, yes, but just lots of drugs, lots of Band-Aids, lots of gauze, lots of everything. And so how much? It's about a fifth of the prison expenditures. 20% of prison expenditures are on healthcare, just like it is out here in so-called free society.
Super interesting. Yeah, I just have to underscore that, especially that chapter, but the book overall really shifted our understanding of privatization in mass incarceration. So there is such wonderful literature on the privatization of the facilities themselves, but your documentation of the contract relationships and how extensive and pervasive and totally wedded to additional systems of privatized or spaces of privatization, I felt was really, really illuminating. And so one of the other areas that you handled so well and really changed our thinking was around thinking through the history of ethics and research on incarcerated people. And so I have to say that I fall prey to this myself, and we in the class together, we've all read and had these kinds of discussions in which there's kind of a will to read exploited research as exploitative in carceral settings, and therefore it must be using Black bodies because of the history of racial capitalism and oppression. And you find in chapter two, in looking closely at the history, and there's a longer conversation I'd also love to have some other day about the really important work of Harriet Washington, to think about the research that was going on in U.S. prisons after World War II and its relationship to the Nuremberg Code. And I feel it helped us see that conventionally there's a distinction between things that are exploitative and therefore bad, and things that are opportunities and therefore good. And yet you're showing this research could be on white incarcerated people, and specifically not Black incarcerated people, because it was both exploitative and also an incredible opportunity. So to develop this a little bit more, I'm going to hand it over to Sheila.
Hi, thanks again so much for being here. So in your book, you discuss the paradoxical timing of post-war medical experiments in the U.S. as prison drug testing programs actually grew most quickly following the Nuremberg Code, which was a response to experiments on prisoners specifically. Could you just talk about how American exceptionalism during the post-war period also works today to justify psychotropics in captive America?
Indeed. American exceptionalism defines how we think about incarceration itself and mass incarceration itself. It no longer is a controversial or even moving moral claim to say that we incarcerate more people than any other nation on earth. People don't even care anymore, right? American exceptionalism, right? We literally are at the pinnacle. We do this better than anybody else. But exceptionalism in that sense, paired with this kind of exceptionalism that pervaded this moment, where it was probably best exemplified at the Nuremberg trials, where one of the Nazi doctors is on the stand and he's like, yes, you know, we learned what we were doing from experiments at the Statesville prison in Illinois. Like we were modeling our research on what you guys were doing. And this was at the trial. And so yet experiments in clinical experiments, in non-therapeutic and therapeutic research experimentation continued in U.S. prisons for decades. It actually accelerated dramatically after this period. And it was because, you know, the Nazis were understood as the kind of penultimate moral failure, and we therefore could not, because we're democratic and our science is exemplary, right? Here in the West, what we're doing is not only done in the name of progress, but it's done in the name of national strength and pride. It's done ultimately, as I uncovered and I think analyzed in the book, to uphold a certain conception of white supremacy linked to citizenship, whereby only, you know, kind of the right to be an experimental patriot was almost reserved for white prisoners. That they got, you know, money, they got maybe time off the block. Some of them got jobs working for the pharmaceutical companies on the studies. And I mean, that was kind of a nice gig in a certain sense. And, you know, just like any other benefit doled out in prison, you know, it was doled out in an inequitable way. And so too, the discourses that accompanied that were inequitable or were stratified, if you will. And so, I still think, regardless of the work of the brilliant work of Washington and many other historians, I'm still looking to see, and again, I have more reading to do always, but we don't really know that history all that well. And so there's archives that have been yet unearthed, and some of that are inaccessible, that would tell us more about that complex racial history and the discourses of exceptionalism that enabled them through over the many decades, and that might make it possible for them to return, which is even more terrifying.
Yeah, speaking of return, the twinned ideas of white supremacism and citizenship. And so the idea that these are just going along side by side, and that citizenship, as it's figured, as we show in chapter three, and, you know, as we know, it's the unmarked category behind ideas of citizenship are whiteness. And that has a lot of bearing on other spaces in which psychotropics are used. And you really get to that in chapter five. And so here I want to hand it over to Myra to explore this a little bit more.
Yeah. So in chapter five, I was really interested in the way the US government used psychotropic drugs as a strategy of psychic torture. So how would you say Agamben's concept of their life connects to the way the US government uses psychotropic drugs in other countries where there is military occupancy in war zones?
This is a good question, Myra, and it's one that, you know, takes us into dark space. I mean, there, the chapter is titled, you know, there are dark days ahead, and there's indeed, you know, trying to get a handle on the ways in which the United States government and its various agencies use psychotropic drugs for a range of missions, whether they be, you know, securing the border, or engaging in their language, and using these practices vis-a-vis ICE, in war zones. Agamben's concept of bare life really has two parts, right? The bios, which is the manner in which life is lived, and zo, which is like the biological fact of life. So there's like the and so bare life would reduce us down to just the biological fact, right? So that the complex social relations that are encompass any human life, those are stripped away, and now we're going to act on you vis-a-vis and through a reduced sense of who you are as a human. You're just an animal, essentially, barely human, if not human, and we'll act on you as such, a kind of reduction to biology and an acting on people through biology. And I think Agamben's concept is useful, because it helps us understand the mechanism that the state thinks it's using when it acts on people in this way, which is to say, the government believes it's using a mechanism that is linked to the control of brains and bodies, right? I mean, this is part of what I think is really interesting about psychotropic drugs as a broad umbrella term, is that when you really drill down at the pharmacology of these substances, we don't quite know how they work. Their mechanisms of action are not fully understood or characterized. So what work they actually do on the body isn't fully resolved itself. Yet we know that when taken, they produce certain effects. And so the mechanism doesn't need to be specified as biological or psychiatric. You don't even need a diagnosis. We're trying to get the effects. And so that's how you see, this is why the bare life concept is useful, because it's less about looking for, you know, a diagnosis in the medical file and the proper specification of whether or not someone should be getting a drug, but rather what is the mission and how are they trying to achieve the mission? And with that question in mind, it's not difficult to see how the state uses these drugs for all sorts of purposes relative to war.
And in addition to Agamben, or building on Agamben, one of the key areas that you get into in the book and conceptualize in the book is thinking through necropolitics and what is to be gained and lost in thinking through these cases in terms of biopower and where you go with necropolitics, thinking with Membe. So Grace is going to pick it up from here.
Yeah. So you describe psychotropics as instituting necropolitics by causing a psychic death. Does this form of political control necessitate some sort of physical or bodily intervention, or could it be done without chemical intervention?
This is, I mean, especially given this last question, this is a good question for us to take up. Is it possible to achieve psychic death in a population without pharmacological intervention? Absolutely, absolutely. You know, the United, here in the United States, at least, the US population is one of the most propagandized populations, you know, over the last 100 years, whether it's propaganda, literally formal propaganda marketing campaigns designed to get us to drink more milk, to do this, to do that. I mean, we start to think expansively about, you know, ideological systems whose function is to train behavior. Shoshana Zuboff, for example, in The Age of Surveillance Capitalism, is looking at, you know, these future behaviors markets and how even our participation in social media is designed not just to understand what we do, but to predict and control what we do. So I would say in broad terms, there are multiple cultural and epistemic systems that are used to psychically kill the population, but maybe we could say, put them in a trance, put them in a sleep, you know, make them comatose. Maybe, you know, they're in a coma. There's certain, maybe they, but they can be revived and resuscitated, right? With critical intervention and education, right? So that term is useful, not just for understanding these kinds of technological interventions on the body, but I think also for understanding the forms of illogical capture that make it hard to think through intervention and how we move forward.
Really interesting. Because the examples that you gave around persuasion and marketing campaigns, these kinds of things, they're all semiotic or linguistic. And I feel like one of the things that is so radical is, despite the fact that you say the book is actually quite conservative, which in terms of the data used, it's very it's fail-safe in terms of the data and your interpretation of it. But what it's showing, and you riff on a bit in the book, is about materiality. And that is specifically what is, I feel like there haven't been many conversations, scholars like you doing this kind of work, to think about the materiality of psychic death and how that's accomplished. So more to say about that, but picking up on the place that necropolitics places in features in the book. So the importance of necropolitics for your analysis. Milan is going to take it from here.
Hi, thank you again, Dr. Hatch, for being here today. This conversation has been so interesting. I wanted to ask, in Discipline and Punish, Foucault discusses the constant surveillance, social isolation, and dehumanizing conditions that have been used to systematically oppress people in carceral institutions. And then you show in the book how forced drugging layers on an additional strategy of discipline. How does the weaponization of psychotropics in these settings change the need for or alter the relationship to Foucauldian forms of discipline?
I have to say, your question had me breaking out my Foucault. I've been blowing dust off the bookshelf and really going back. And in all honesty, I've been wrestling and reckoning with Michel Foucault's philosophy and his historiography for many, many years now, both in terms of trying to understand his theorizations of biopower and biopolitics vis-a-vis race and racism, the institutions of state and how they engage in the government of health in the population. And of course, not just on the medical side, but of course in the carceral setting. The book Discipline and Punish is really foundational to our understanding of how carcerality works. And yet it leaves some things unresolved. And that's, you know, it's kind of hard to, I'll just say, I don't think that what's happening with psychotropics is actually disciplining. I think it's a form of pacification. And that's not necessarily, you know, if discipline was supposed to produce a body that was docile and useful, and these bodies are useful, even through their dying, slow psychic dying, they're still consuming, they're still profitable in that sense. And yet I think that that is a kind of, it's producing a pacified population as opposed to one that is disciplined vis-a-vis its utility. The usefulness of the population doesn't come from its, how that is converted into policy and kind of political currency or economic currency. Those things aren't even measured, right? They don't really even know It's more about, we've got to do something with these people, just put them there. And how do we do that? How do we achieve that? And to me, that's where the abolitionist mission in Silent Cells really is there. You know, I wanted to produce a book that could take a leg out from underneath the system of mass incarceration. How do you stand it up? You can't do it, I don't think, without these medications in place. And so they do, these mechanisms, these technologies, these practices do accompany existing forms of government vis-a-vis discipline and surveillance. Yet they are also distinct from them and don't require surveillance. You don't even need to get, they're giving out drugs in more prisons than they're doing evaluations, right? So they don't even need to evaluate you to give you the drug. So there's a severing of some of Foucault's conceptions of knowledge and power, rethinking of it, if you will, that we don't need to know what was wrong with you to give you this. We're just going to give it to you because we need to. And I think that that is one of the ways in which I think about how this weaponization of psychotropics, you know, should have us rethinking the kind of power that's being deployed here, or the kind of power that characterizes these relationships between people and the state.
So much more to talk about here, and we've already taken so much of your time. I would love just to wrap up with one last a bit big question, but I want to really hear you talk more about the abolitionist project, not only behind this book, but behind your previous book, Blood Sugar, on racial pharmacology, your lab at Wesleyan, the Black Box Lab, which looks amazing. But could you, just to kind of wrap us up, speculate, sort of do a speculative history of the future around decarceration? So what is this speculative abolitionism that you want to think through and imagine?
This is a question that gives me pause. And it gives me pause in for all the right reasons. And that is that it occurred to me in writing Silent Cells, and I write about this in the book, that I was no longer interested in producing liberal social science that could be easily, you know, incorporated into a program of reform. I thought that I wanted to be producing kind of liberatory social science that was asking the kinds of questions that come from below, the people who are, you know, subordinated under these social arrangements, whose voices are often not heard, etc. That trying to raise questions from that standpoint, those standpoints, is what Silent Cells aim to do. And in raising those questions, you know, I kind of let go of the need to offer as many prescriptions as I did at the end of Blood Sugar, actually, trying to offer kind of a, here's some things we might do. Instead, I think that I wrote Silent Cells as an offering to my friends and who are out there organizing. I'm a college professor. I teach and write and run a lab, and then trying to push on this front that I'm in now. You know, if this is a big grand war, you know, for liberation, for democracy, for the future, you know, I'm positioned here in my spot. I got to hold this down, and I need other people to be doing their spot where they are. And so I wanted to offer up the most well-researched, evidenced book I could to show the relationship between these drugging practices and mass incarceration, not just imprisonment, but captivity writ large, as an offering to the abolitionist forms of organizing, teaching, and scholarship that continue to try to poke at the linchpins, the cornerstones of these institutions. I couldn't, and so that's where I start, you know, is that the book has let me have so many conversations with folks who are doing the work. And to me, that's where the solution comes from, us talking, organizing together, not from some hilltop, mountaintop, ivory tower, something like that, but really look at what's happening. And it's just been remarkable, from whether it's prison physicians or formerly incarcerated people who've said to me, or you're onto something, you know, your book is right. And so now, you know, there's a kind of, recognizing that take it for granted could be changed is where we are.
Yeah. Well, let us all here echo that. Your book is right. and this abolitionist present that you're sort of enacting in all your forms of work is a great model, and we're here in solidarity with that. And so your speculative present, it's not reform, it's revolution. Right now. So Tony, Dr. Hatch, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you all so much for the wonderful questions, and please be safe out there.